All right, hearing. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Jill Karofsky presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Good morning, everybody. Please have a seat. Good morning. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We have some special visitors here. And before we get started, I would like to welcome them. I understand we have some visitors from Beloit Memorial High School. Would you stand up so we could say good morning to all of you? Well, welcome. We're glad that you are here. Thanks for being here. Yeah, you can go and have a seat. I also want to welcome visitors from Port Washington High School. Will you please stand up? Amazing. Thank you for being here. Go ahead and have a seat. And then we also have visitors from Lakeshore College in Cleveland. You all stand up. Welcome. We're glad you're here. It's my understanding that Justice Protasiewicz is going to meet with you after our oral arguments today. She'll answer all of your questions. And if you run out of questions, come find me because I got lots of questions I want to ask her. The first case we have today is Waukesha County versus RDT. Can I have the appearances, please?
Not for RDT.
Good morning. And my understanding is that it's 25 minutes, 30 minutes, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal. Yes. All right. Attorney Haskell, whenever you are ready.
Good morning. I believe that this case is primarily about respect for this court's precedents. Following this court's decision in SAM about 4 years ago, the Court of Appeals and separate writings from this court have almost uniformly recognized that the decision from SAM announced a categorical or a bright line rule that appeals in recommitments of an involuntary commitment are not moot. We're asking that the court simply affirm that ruling for largely the same reasons that it decided SAM in the first instance. I mean, first being the Second Amendment consequences that flow from a recommitment, second being the cost of care consequences that the court discussed there. And we're asking the court to also go further in identifying that categorical rule and to discuss the stigma also that flows from these commitments. I think that the court has correctly recognized in SAM and in countless other decisions recognizing the severity and the seriousness of the due process deprivations that are involved in involuntary commitment and involuntary recommitments, that they simply justify leaving open access to appellate review for the individuals who are committed and not allowing the government to declare the individual dangerous and in need of a commitment and then shutting off access to that appellate review. I think that as to mootness, I think that the most straightforward ground for affirming from SAM is the Second Amendment consequence that was discussed there. In this case, as in SAM, RDT has been barred from possessing a firearm under Chapter 51, and the only opportunity that he has to reinstate that right is prescribed in the statute and identifies that it is an assessment of his record and reputation that the court will review. And I think that the opportunity to reverse one of these commitments improves that argument as to his record and reputation. I think this is precisely what the court was talking about in SAM, that there is, even if marginal, and improved view of his record that he's able to present when the court reverses one of the commitments, even if there have been a couple. I think that in SAM, the court involved three separate commitments that had been that occurred in that case. In this case, there have been five. And I don't think that there's any reason for drawing a distinction between the two. I think that Chapter 5120, sub 13, sub CV that discusses reinstating the Second Amendment right, reviews the entirety of the record and reputation and allows a person to reinstate their Second Amendment rights without any of their commitments being reversed or being, you know, decided on appeal. Even if all of them remain, this is still an argument that is able to be pursued. And I think that SAM correctly recognizes that, again, it improves that assessment when you're able to challenge one of them and then to make those arguments. And I think that it's presumptuous to decide at the outset of a direct appeal that, well, we don't think it's going to matter in the assessment of his record and reputation in the future if he ever decides to petition to reinstate his Second Amendment right. And the problem is, I mean, again, it puts the cart before the horse in that I think it's that successive court that needs to decide his record and reputation, not the appellate court in the first instance to try and declare, we don't think this is going to matter to an assessment of his record and reputation in the future, and so we should dismiss this appeal as moot. And instead, you know, the finding should be that there is this finding of non-mootness, that it is for the successive court that is going to be answering that question to actually have to decide, oh, does that one commitment, you know, matter in the assessment? And then I think that the Court of Appeals decision from LXDO gets at some of the ways that challenging one commitment can in fact have sort of like downstream effects as well, that we can see that, you know, by challenging this commitment, it may allow, you know, a future reviewing court to see the problems that may exist in successive commitments, that maybe there are similar evidentiary problems that exist there or that it can call into question. And again, result in this improved view of the person's record and reputation for purposes of determining whether to reinstate the Second Amendment right.
Let me ask you this. He's been recommitted, what, four times, I think? Is that correct?
Correct.
Do you think that at some point, when somebody's being recommitted as many times as your client has, that vacating one recommitment ceases to have any practical effect?
I think that it still has a practical effect in that the court is, again, in the future going to potentially have to decide the individual's record and reputation at that point. And that's where I think that the court recognized that the potential consequence here, even if marginal, even if the change could be marginal, that it is still a collateral consequence mm-hmm. that justifies leaving open access to direct appellate review rather than shutting it off at the outset and preventing even that assessment at that stage.
Along the lines of what Justice Protasiewicz asked, when you're talking about stigma as one of your reasons that you want us to now expand the grounds for not being moot, at what point does stigma reach that level? Is it the third commitment? Is it the fourth? Is it the fifth? Like, how would we, is it always any stigma ever committed anytime?
I think that the court should really hold that it is any stigma. I think that the problem is not only societal stigma, which I think is sort of what the county focuses on a bit in their briefings, but that there is also the individualized stigma, the internal stigma for the individual in their lives, and that there is this opportunity that they have to, you know, vindicate that appellate right, to see that reversed, even if there is only one that winds up being challenged, that there is that, you know, sort of personal dignity. And I think that that's what's reflected in, you know, from United States Supreme Court cases, the cases from this court, you know, that recognize the severity of the due process infringement that is involved in an involuntary commitment. And I think that that's where it honors the reality of that liberty deprivation to allow then the successive exercise of the appellate right, rather than to, again, shut that off. And I don't know that it matters that there's a particular number. I mean, I acknowledge that an alternative to pursuing this line that is addressed in the briefing, and that some other states, you know, I quote Iowa, I know at length in our brief, you know, at least recognize that at the very least it's presumptuous, or that it's presumptively non-moot, that maybe there is some sort of case-by-case assessment that we need to engage in. But I guess that's what I'm encouraging the court to try to get away from, and that I think that the court thought it was getting away from in deciding SAM, that this is not an issue that should be involved in appeals, direct appeals of involuntary commitments, that it is always not moot, that this is not a side issue that needs to be decided, that this is not a section of every brief that goes to the Court of Appeals on the issue, that in fact, the right to pursue that appeal is paramount in these cases, and that there is not a need to try and have a case-by-case assessment of, well, they had five commitments versus seven commitments, and maybe the nature of the dangerousness. And again, I think we quickly get down a path of, I mean, for example, in assessing the Second Amendment right, of trying to figure out what a future court might think is relevant, again, to determining the person's record and reputation. And that all of a sudden we're saying, well, we don't think this one's going to matter in the future. And so this appeal is moot because there have now been five commitments instead of six or instead of four.
Counsel, if we agree with you on the collateral consequence, the impact on his Second Amendment rights is sufficient to render the case not moot. Don't we stop there? Like, why would we reach the what I see as an alternative argument that you're raising about stigma?
Yeah, I don't think that it's utterly necessary that the court go beyond what it did in SAM. I mean, I think even in SAM, this court, you know, identified there two collateral consequences. And so I don't think that it is necessary for the court's decision to do that. I think that it simply clarifies for the future, for any future decisions from lower courts. I mean, I think that, again, while the Court of Appeals has more or less uniformly understood SAM to have been categorical, I mean, the appeal in this case and the other case, I think, JLH that we identify in our petition for review, I mean, the court is trying to identify ways of distinguishing it from the case that was, or the facts of SAM. And so I think to sort of avoid those attempts at factual distinctions, I think that recognizing the stigma does that and sort of puts an end to this as a matter of litigation and sort of declares that no, in fact, this is an issue worthy of appellate review. I think that it also takes this as an issue. I mean, I acknowledge the Second Amendment consequences and the cost of care consequences are statutory in nature. And I have no control over what the legislature is going to do or any changes that may exist there. And I think that in order to protect that right to appellate review in involuntary commitments.
Well, let me just ask a follow-up, because you began your argument saying this case is about respect for precedent and cited SAM. What you're laying out now, though, seems to be quite a departure from SAM, and asking us to find categorically that recommitment orders are not moot when they're appealed based on stigma. That seems to me to be a departure from the approach outlined in SAM and would require us to, if not overrule, you know, certainly narrow SAM. Is that what you're asking us to do?
No, I don't think so. I don't know that. I think that SAM, read correctly, is in fact a categorical decision in the first instance. And so I don't think that asking the court to consider this third collateral consequence, one that was presented in SAM, requires distinguishing SAM in any way. I mean, I think that the court can author an opinion in this case that says everything we said in SAM still stands. These recommitment appeals are not moot, and they're also not moot because of the stigma associated with an involuntary recommitment.
So we don't typically take a case just to say, you know, we decided SAM in June of 2022, and we really, really meant it. That's what I'm hearing you argue.
I understand that. I think that the problem that we presented in our petition for review, at least, is that the Court of Appeals has not seemed to recognize that, albeit only with limited exceptions. That SAM was in fact a categorical rule. I think that it did state that. I think that there have been writings that again have categorized it as a bright line rule, that again, LXDO from the Court of Appeals, separate writings from this court have read it as such. And I think that that's the correct reading. And so, it's not my place to, I guess, comment on the reasons that the court has decided to grant review in a case. I think that the Court of Appeals failure to abide by this court's holding in SAM, it was a worthy reason to decide this case alone, if only to make sure that SAM was respected for what it decided. And given this opportunity that we are here, I am only, again, urging the court to, perhaps consider addressing the stigma consideration that, again, it was presented in DK, that was presented in SAM, and to finally sort of resolve that as part of this entire equation.
So your argument is, write an opinion that says SAM still good law and stop there.
I think that the court could do that. I think that SAM is good law. And again, perhaps needing to reinforce that SAM did state a categorical rule, lest, again, we wind up with cases like this one that involve situations where the Court of Appeals attempts to draw a distinction from the facts presented in SAM. and that it's treated as the categorical rule that it was intended to be.
You also have a second part of your brief, though, that talks about the inadmissible hearsay. So are you, you're not just asking us to find it's not moot, right? Or change your mind?
No, that's a fair characterization. I suppose that I've been thinking of this narrowly as we've been discussing mootness.
Okay.
As to the mootness section, I suppose as to section one in this court's decision, yes, I would urge
that. So what do you want out of this?
Before you switch, can I just, I just want to ask two follow-ups on the mootness question. First of all, I'm glad you liked SAM. I thought it was well written. I do have a question. Your friend on the other side, in regard to the firearm ban, noted that your client had not petitioned the circuit court to restore his firearm rights, despite having the opportunity to do so. I wanted to give you, should that matter at all?
No, I mean, for one, there's nothing about that in the record. For two, no, it's not relevant. I mean, it was not, I think, at issue in SAM either. It is the opportunity in the future to reinstate the Second Amendment right that is relevant to the court's determination of mootness, not whether there is an active petition to reinstate the Second Amendment right.
And second, in your brief, you talked, and in SAM, of course, we talked about the, in this case, would be the debt to Waukesha County for the care under the challenged order. And your friend on the other side said, first of all, made two arguments there, two factual arguments, that one, your client did not present a debt before the circuit court, and two, that your client does not now present a debt before this court. So I just want to give you the opportunity to respond to that, if you would.
Yeah, as to both, I think that, again, this puts us on all fours with SAM, that the statute imposes the liability, that the statute makes RDT responsible for these costs of care services that are associated with the commitment, and that the potential for collection exists in the future. I mean, to dismiss the appeal as moot, the court could dismiss the appeal as moot, and then the next day, the county could potentially go ahead and try to make that collection. There's no requirement that the collection actually be active. And again, this court in SAM expressly stated that there did not need to be a showing that debt collections had already begun, because the financial liability rests with the individual who's subject to the commitment.
Thank you. Thanks, Justice Dell. I just thought it'd be easier to
finish that
conversation
that.
Before a transition.
Yeah. So
Hearsay. That time? All right. So, you know, I think the hearsay issue in this case is really just a simple matter of statutory interpretation, that the county has advanced a novel argument that the recommitment standard allowing the county to rely on information from the individual's treatment record to show dangerousness, you know, is read as an evidentiary or hearsay exception. I mean, again, I note in my brief, they've characterized it as a hearsay exception. I'm not entirely sure why it's not an exception to the rules of evidence generally, as read the way that they've applied it. I simply don't know how the statute is properly read as an exception to the rules of evidence. I think that in JWK from this court, I think it got quoted in DJW, what the recommitment standard language there is defining is the relaxed burden that the county faces, not an evidentiary issue. It's about an evidentiary pathway, that there could be cases where the person is doing really well on medications and is showing no signs of dangerousness, and maybe has shown no signs of dangerousness for 2 years. Because they've been taking medications, they've been complying with
treatment. Let me ask you this. How much background information do you think the county needs to elicit in a recommitment hearing if somebody's been recommitted for years and years? And the reason I ask you that, I used to do these CHIPS hearings at Children's Court many years ago, and we would have to find witnesses from years and years prior to be able to prove up our CHIPS case or maybe our termination of parental rights case. It seems to me a little unwieldy and unworkable in these particular cases to have the county rely on witnesses who may have offered reports or proffered testimony a decade ago. How do we deal with that?
I think that there are any number of other rules of evidence that control most of this. I mean, for one, I think that the Court of Appeals decision from CH is one that's cited in my appendix that discusses the fact that, I mean, one, video testimony is available. And so if the county does need to go back to call some of the like firsthand witnesses who have observed dangerous conduct, they can resort to, you know, video testimony as one way to kind of streamline this process. I think that another alternative, I mean, you mentioned this, these situations were 10 years ago, or you're trying to track down people that you can't find them. I mean, if in this particular case where, again, there's evidence that RDT's mother and father seem to have been witness to that, you know, I get the county may have wanted to rely on. If they testified at that original commitment hearing and they are unavailable for one reason, I mean, their former testimony satisfies a hearsay exception and could potentially be admissible that way if they need to. And so I think that they have ways still of proving their cases. I mean, sort of returning to the, I think the origin of your question about like how they do it. I mean, again, it's kind of not for me to figure out exactly. I mean, they can figure out how far back they want to go to call the original fact witnesses versus, I mean, calling somebody who, if the person is in a locked unit in a mental institution, I mean, there could be contemporaneous evidence even of threats. I mean, we review these cases all the time at the public defender's office. And yeah, sometimes they're just direct threats that are made to the doctor, that are made to the social worker who can testify to them. And that can be pretty strong evidence of dangerousness. It's that in this case, we're again left mostly with in the social worker's report that the county is relying on predominantly. I mean, again, we've got, for one, the multiple levels of hearsay problem, which we can discuss, but I mean, that it is evidence that has happened, you know, years ago, and that there are other social workers that could be called. If he's in Waukesha County and there's a Jefferson County social worker who observed conduct, they can call that person and they can figure it out as far as presenting this. And that's really important to, I think, remember that, like, these are not simply hearings. I mean, these are trials. There is a right to a jury that these individuals can exercise. I don't know that, you know, this is a situation where, you know, we should be looking for evidentiary shortcuts in the presentation of the case. And then again, the question really becomes dictated again by the statutory language in that recommitment standard and the fact that under 5120, the rules of evidence apply unless provided otherwise. And I don't think that we can read this language in the recommitment standard as otherwise.
You're not suggesting that the county in this situation would have to go back and prove the fact that your client was initially dangerous, right? Because under 5121 AM, the standard is, thank you for my glasses, back.
So thank you.
That the court was able to reach a conclusion that there is a substantial likelihood that your client would be a proper subject for commitment if treatment were withdrawn. So you don't have to prove the underlying dangerous conduct.
No, not necessarily. I think that it's important because the doctor's opinion is oftentimes, again, focused on like how the person would become dangerous if treatment were withdrawn. And so because we need to answer that question, I mean, I think that it can be useful then for the county to want to present some evidence of dangerous, like this is how he's going to become dangerous. This is what may happen if treatment is withdrawn. I think that's how, you know, going back and presenting some of it may become relevant. I mean, if there is simply information in the treatment record that is admissible under another, you know, hearsay rule, then yeah, it would seem like they could rely on that and maybe even just through the doctor's testimony to say, you know, this is how they're going to become dangerous. But it's that, you know, under DJW, this court, you know, emphasizing again that even in these recommitment cases, and we need to know how they're becoming dangerous. I mean, we want factual findings that the recommitment standard is not, you know, a shortcut, just a different way of doing it.
What do we do about the fact here that I get that there was an objection to the treatment records, but when we review it for harmless error, we look at the entire record and all the testimony came in without objection. So you've got testimony from the doctor, testimony from the social worker, that even if you took out the treatment records, it's all in there in terms of supporting the finding here. And what do we do with that?
Sure. My concern there is the role that the trial court played in attempting not to rely on any of that and seeming to indicate that that was not influencing his decision when making his ruling in the case. I mean, the findings that were made were a little bit sparse, but, you know, focus on the evidence from the reports that were comments made by RDT specifically seemed to be the only thing that the trial court was relying on. And so I don't know that we need to be looking beyond that to all of the evidence that the court did not rely on that may not have been credited by the trial court in the first instance. I mean, I think that what would be the better remedy under facts like this would be to, with insufficient factual findings by the trial court, to remand for improved factual findings would, you know, if we were here in a criminal matter or another civil matter, that's what I'd suggest. And the difficulty being, I recognize that there is no basis for remand for those findings at this point because the circuit court has lost competency to act further. And thus, this court would be able to announce a rule as to the evidence in this case, or as to the recommitment standard not being a hearsay exception, and then would be left to reverse, but no opportunity to remand for the trial court to sort of clean up the record.
But does it matter what the trial court relied on if we're looking at it de novo and reviewing the evidence de novo? I mean, we're looking at what was brought in without hearsay objections. So maybe the circuit court made the findings in one way, look at it a different way, right? Because it's a de novo review.
I suppose I think that the court is then sort of stepping into the place of the trial court and again, relying on evidence that the trial court was sort of expressly not taking into account. I mean, I understand that a contemporaneous objection to the oral testimony was not made, but the trial court, it is unclear to me from the trial court's rulings that it was not more or less granting that objection in retrospect when making its findings, that it was not saying, okay, I'm going to exclude the hearsay that's been involved in this case. I'm going to decide the case based only on the statements of RDT. And that I think that it would be more appropriate, again, under the circumstances, to have the circuit court make its factual findings based on the evidence that it finds to be, you know, admissible or based on the evidence that it's crediting, rather than this court is sort of reading everything in the testimony as credible, essentially, and just looking for the evidence that then would affirm or allow, you know, upholding the recommitment in this case.
There was a suggestion, I think it was in the county's brief, maybe the state mentioned it too in theirs, but about just with regard to the healthcare costs, sorry, going back to the mootness question for a minute, that what would happen if the, you know, county or state affirmatively waived any rights to reimbursement? And I'm not sure exactly how that looks logistically. So I'm curious if you have any comment or thoughts on that. And then maybe a somewhat related question, just in between your briefing, it was, you know, felt like that, you know, Spider-Man meme where they're both pointing at each other. Well, you didn't raise any evidence. Well, neither did you. So there seemed to be that approach to the underlying, you know, record of ability to pay and those things, which again may not be relevant under SAM, but I'm just curious whether you have any comment on that, on that sure. piece.
Chief, may I? I have my red light.
Yeah, please do.
Thank you. As to the cost of care, I do not believe that it was in the county's brief. I think that the county's association's non-party brief and the state's brief have both, you know, alluded to the potential for, you know, waiving these costs and, again, the potential for overruling that cost of care portion of SAM. I guess I would stand mostly on what I wrote in my reply brief, that I don't think that this court should be entertaining requests of non-parties to overrule precedent. I'm not sure exactly what method as well the county would be able to take to try to like affirmatively waive their ability to collect. You know, I of course don't believe that it's material because of the Second Amendment consequence that still exists because of SAM. If there is a way that the county can somehow override the statutory imposition of liability, I suppose that could cause a little bit of confusion when it comes to the applicability of that collateral consequence of the recommitment. But having seen no way that we are in fact sort of absolving that financial responsibility, I don't know that it matters particularly.
Anyone have any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Martin.
Good morning. May it please this court. My name is John Martin. I represent the interests of the public for Waukesha County. SAM did not establish a categorical rule that civil commitments are never moot. SAM reiterated long-standing principle that mootness is overcome by a practical effect of reversal. That is not present here. Not all individuals owe a debt for costs of care during the commitment period. No debt means no potential collection, means no collection. Waukesha County cannot collect against someone that doesn't owe it a debt. SAM did not establish a categorical rule. I ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals' dismissal of RDT's appeal as moot. I do so for three reasons. The first reason is nothing in this record suggests that RDT owes a debt to Waukesha County for the services he received under the commitment.
Could you just address, maybe you're getting to this, but SAM talked about the statute by operation imposing liability. You saying there's not a debt, I don't really understand that. Can you make that connection for me?
Yes. What in paragraph 25 of SAM, and I certainly recognize that there are five justices before me that did sit on that court, and that I am somewhat telling this court what I think it says. So SAM in paragraph 25, it states it is enough to overcome mootness when there is the potential for collection actions because of the liability. If insurance has already paid for all of the costs of care, then there is no liability. If a third party has already paid for all of the costs of care, then there is no liability. If RDT has already paid for all of the costs of care, then there is no liability. In order for liability to mean something, to have a practical effect, there must still be a debt in existence. Otherwise, a collection action doesn't mean anything.
Right. But I want to talk to you a little bit more then about paragraph 25 in SAM. And that paragraph has to do with what you were just talking about, because he presented no evidence of collection efforts against his debt by the time of the appeal. SAM states this position misses the mark for two related reasons. First, it is irrelevant whether collection efforts have begun, regardless. And second, it is enough to overcome mootness when there's the potential for collection actions. That language certainly concerns me about the viability of your argument.
Thanks, Justice Protasiewicz.
Tell me where I'm wrong.
The liability has already been satisfied. The liability's been satisfied. It's been paid.
Says who? Like, where do you get that from? Is that in the record?
I'm saying that in order for, if no debt has been asserted, and there's no debt.
How does someone assert debt? They're liable under the statute. You're saying it's somehow been paid. Are you asserting in this particular instance it's not moot because RDT has paid the whole thing? And if you're saying that, where is the proof of that?
We have not seen that in the
record.
I'm
thinking that's not true. I'm thinking you're asserting hypotheticals of times where that might happen.
Well, my argument would be that a prima facie showing of mootness exists when Waukesha County asserts that the case is moot based upon the expired commitment. And the burden then shifts to RDT to state how there is an actual practical effect.
Except that's not what SAM said. SAM said there's liability, period, point blank. If you're going to say in this case there isn't because of some of the reasons, now that would be an interesting case to bring in front of us. If there was a reason that insurance paid the cost of care, that RDT paid the cost of care, that there really truly couldn't be, the liability was abstract because it was all satisfied, that would be an interesting case. But I don't know that that's the case here.
Waukesha County attempted to supplement the record in this case before the Supreme Court. It was denied. It continues to assert that the record should be supplemented to show those costs of care and whether they exist. There's an affidavit that's present that shows what the cost of care is, whether there's any debt remaining, and I reassert that that should become part of this record.
I understand that, but we typically don't. I mean, the record is the record in front of the Court of Appeals. If you thought this was moot in front of the Court of Appeals, that would be part of the record that you brought to them.
I understand.
And plus, I don't even know if it's waivable based on the shall language in the statute. I don't even know if Waukesha County can say we're waiving it or we're not going to collect.
And my argument is not that it has to do with waiver. It has to do with the fact that when you get a bill for $10 and you pay that bill for $10, I can't then go and collect and say you owe me $10. That's my argument, is that the bill says it's $100. That bill was paid and there's no potential to collect from it because it's paid.
Counsel, I'm trying to follow this. If the person does pay for the costs of care while simultaneously appealing a recommitment order, arguably, if that recommitment order is overturned, they would be eligible to have those monies returned to them, wouldn't they?
I disagree, because they received the care. They received that care. They got the benefit of that care. I want to address firearms, and what I want to say about firearms is this has to do with the record and reputation. The record and reputation did not stop for RDT at the third extension, the one that this court is reviewing. It continued to the fourth extension, and at that fourth extension, the circuit court heard the evidence of his reputation for dangerousness from the initial commitment, the first extension, the second extension, the third extension. All of that evidence was admitted. Circuit courts are not naive. Just because this court would vacate the third order doesn't mean that they're not going to then consider the evidence that it had admitted in the fourth extension about the third order, because it was vacated. It was still admitted evidence. That subsequent extension is crucial because it establishes a firearm prohibition after the challenged order. That's not yet been reviewed by this court before. More importantly, when we get to a restoration hearing, all relevant evidence is admissible as long as it meets with the elements, the individual's record and reputation for dangerousness, and whether it's not contrary to public interest. I can show up to that hearing as the public, and I can assert all relevant evidence to that circuit court, including the third extension's evidence. And the argument is really the firearms. We have five orders. If we remove one of them, we have four orders, but we have the initial commitment, the first extension, the second extension, the fourth extension, and the middling order is not a practical effect on whether or not this court, the circuit court, will restore firearms.
So, counsel,
I think, go ahead, just a second.
Oh, thanks, Chief. I want to just actually, you were making a broader argument about how these arguments should play out. And I want to just probe that for just a second. You mentioned that you think that the way this should happen is you make an argument that this is moot and that that makes a prima facie case. And then the burden shifts to the committed individual to show that it's not moot, I suppose. And then raise evidence. And I don't know if that's true on firearm or if you're just saying that's true for, you know, cost of care. And so my question for you, am I understanding that correctly? Please feel free to explain that. And my second question is whether you have any authority for that proposition.
Justice Hagedorn, to answer the first question, that is what I'm saying. Waukesha County, prima facie evidence, orders expired. Then it goes to the collateral consequences. There is not case that says that's how the burden works. I'm offering that as what this court should hold the test to be. But what I would say is RDT asserts the collateral consequence, and it's really based upon a conclusory type of argument. It's not specified. It's not, I have $400,000 worth of cost of care. This statute says that I'm statutory liable for it. He's in the best position to do that. And since he's the one that's asserting the collateral consequence, it's my position that he should bear that offering to show that evidence. I have $100,000 to show why it is that stigma impacts him in a certain way.
Normally when a party wants to establish mootness, isn't it usually on the party seeking to establish mootness? Isn't it usually their job to make their case? Maybe not. If I'm wrong, feel free to tell me, but that usually seems to be the default position.
Waukesha County is the one that says it's moot because it's expired. It's moot because it's expired, and it should not be their burden, in my opinion, to think of all of the potential collateral consequences that RDT could raise or that any individual subject to commitment could raise. And that's my position.
So, counsel, are you saying all the county has to do is to say it's moot and the other party has to show it's not? Is that, it just is a mere assertion that has to be made?
It's moot because, in this case, it's moot because the
order has expired.
Order has expired. The extension happened and he's discharged from commitment.
And that's something that is happening during the course of the appeal, correct? The expiration of the order, I mean, that those are the facts on the ground are changing because appeals take a long time, right? When he filed the appeal, the recommitment order was still ongoing, I presume, right?
Yes, I agree. I won't go as far as to say appeals take a long time. I think there are ways in which appeals don't have to take that long of a time. For example, even if you max out the statutory structure on appeals, you follow the time limits under 80930 and you max them out, the Court of Appeals should receive the brief at 300 days. So while that doesn't work for an initial commitment, if it's a recommitment and it's 12 months long, they receive it at the 9-month mark. And the Court of Appeals in this case issued their decision quite readily.
But it seems to me that what you're asking for is some kind of an evidentiary hearing or a fact-based showing to be made after the appeal has been commenced and after some, you know, some things change because the order has expired. And I just have some questions about that from a practical standpoint, how the person under the commitment is supposed to bring forward those facts that are at that point outside the record.
I understand, and that's really one reason why SAM could be seen as unworkable, because not all individuals owe a debt. Some individuals are on Medicaid. Medicaid pays for everything. And if that's the case, there's no collection that's happening. $100,000 of care, $100,000 paid, and there's zero in the balance. There's no potential collection.
We look forward to that case. Can I move you on to the hearsay issue unless other people have questions on this part?
Yes.
You're asking for a pretty bold statement here that it, basically the rules of evidence, i.e. the hearsay rules, don't apply because of some language in the statute here about treatment records. So can you tell us why we should adopt your theory?
Yes, I'd love to. So it's not that the rules of civil procedure don't apply in totality, right? 5120 sub 10 sub C says the rules of civil procedure apply, except as otherwise provided. 90802 says hearsay, except as otherwise provided by statute. 5120 1AM says recent acts or omissions, a pattern of recent acts or omissions, may be shown based on a substantial likelihood. You get to use the treatment record, and what does it have to show? It has to show that if without treatment, they become a proper subject for commitment. It's not even the whole, it's not, element C is more than just a pattern of acts or omissions. Element C also talks about Chapter 55 exclusion. Element C also talks about whether they'll avail themselves to services. The only part that we get to rely on hearsay for is to show that those recent acts or admissions that we've already proved in most cases happened.
But where does it, going back to, you laid out exactly the otherwise specified language in the other parts, but where does it talk about hearsay here? Just because you can use treatment records or rely on them doesn't mean they aren't still subject to the rules of hearsay. I don't see, if it wanted to say hearsay rules don't apply, wouldn't that subsection 1AM say just that?
I'd ask this court to benefit from the Court of Appeals analysis on this. Portage County v. DPW. I'm sorry, DPWO. DPWO identifies no way in which this hearsay evidence is particularly notable or unusual. In fact, evidence drawn from the recommitment standard is expressly contemplated.
It may be, again, maybe contemplated, but does that mean you throw the hearsay rules out?
District 3, Brown County v. MJ.
I mean, I'll read that again. I still don't see how you're asking for a really broad proposition. I mean, treatment records contain all kinds of things, some of which may be have hearsay exceptions that allow them to come in, including statements of the party opponent, right? So RDT statements potentially, or Attorney Haskell identified some other exceptions that might apply. I mean, there's certainly, it's not that they're either in or they're out, but why would hearsay not apply here just as it's said that all the rules of civil procedure apply?
What would the statute mean if not for us allowing the petitioner to apply the treatment records to show it?
Isn't it about the fact that you don't have to prove an act, another act? Isn't that what that whole section is about? That you don't have to show a recent act, that the legislature has determined that when you're in a recommitment setting, treatment records can be enough. Isn't that what it says? That's not about hearsay or not hearsay.
And if that is what it says, then I believe, in my opinion, DJW went way too far, because the jurisprudence that DJW left us with is the petitioners, the subject individuals stating basically like the recommitments are an initial hearing, and you have to assert that RDT pushed his mother into a corner, carried around knives like Rambo, set up lures and traps around his house, face to face with his dad, delusional, possessing guns in his pants concealed.
Attorney Martin, let me ask it this way. Assume that we don't find the way you're asking us to on mootness, and assume that we are not agreeing with you on the hearsay question. I want to know, as you look at the conclusions that were made by the trial court in this case, what admissible non-hearsay evidence, thank you, would allow the conclusion that there was a substantial likelihood that RDT would be a proper subject for commitment if treatment were withdrawn under 5121 AM?
Are you asking for what the circuit court's factual findings were, or what was asserted into the record?
I think what she's asking you to answer, and I was going to ask you the same thing, is whether or not you think there was sufficient testimony, if we set aside the reports, to support the recommitment order. Is that correct, Chief?
Yes.
Okay.
Because, and part of the reason I'm asking is because I'm looking at too many things on my computer. What I'm doing. I'm looking at the Court of Appeals decision, and it appears that they maybe conduct a harmless error analysis in paragraphs 15 or 16, but I wouldn't say they're all that robust. And so I'm wondering if, when it comes to the sufficiency of the evidence, as Justice Protasiewicz said, how would you ask us to analyze that? What information should we be considering?
So the record 178, page 7, Ms. Weber testifies he was having increased symptoms, becoming aggressive towards his mother, pushed his mother into a corner, causing her pain and causing her to feel unsafe, concealing a knife in his sleeve for protection due to the hallucinations and delusions that he had, that he believed there were intruders who were trying to enter his home, that he had to protect himself and his family. During the period of commitment, there was also an OWI second, which is mentioned within Ms. Weber's testimony as well. OWI second shows impaired judgment, taking and consuming alcohol while on an antipsychotic medication, impaired judgment, deciding to drive while on those two substances, impaired judgment to get pulled over by a police officer in some fashion. But it's those acts that I would ask this court to use to establish the pattern. And simply when we have pairing that with Dr. Rainey's testimony, he states that if RDT stopped his medication, his symptoms would increase and he would become physically aggressive towards others. That's the argument, is that the acts that Danielle Weber testified to lead to the Dr. Rainey's ultimate opinion that those acts are going to come back again, because he's not going to take medications, which will lead him to become symptomatic and the behaviors to revisit.
Thank you.
I want to address a little bit about harmless error because DJW, you know, when I was preparing for this case, it's SAM, it's DJW, it's this conflict of, you know, did SAM open the floodgates? Did DJW open the floodgates? But in my practice, what I've seen is we really see DJW time and time and time again raised in almost every single appeal. And I implore this court to consider harmless error once and for all. And the facts of this case really bear that out when we have a sufficiency of the evidence, as I've just shown through the testimony. But then, as RDT points out, we have the circuit court maybe not restate the facts as they exactly came out. For example, one of the things the circuit court found was that RDT appeared to have made homicidal and suicidal statements to the independent exam, and RDT never talked to the independent examiners. However, when we look at the record in its totality, it's somewhat harmless based upon the fact that RDT actually made those homicidal and suicidal statements to his parents when he broke into their room in January of 2023. And the reality is DJW, if we want meaningful appellate review and we want to avoid mootness, then RDT should file a motion for post-disposition hearing. And he should go back to the circuit court before the orders expired, and he should tell the circuit court, you didn't do enough. But why would he do that when he can wait and he can then assert before this court, you can't remand this. It's expired. That's the problem. I want to talk about the legislative intent, and this statute is about treatment. This statute's about treatment. I've been on both sides of the aisle. I've been a public defender for 4 years. I worked in the Milwaukee Mental Health Unit. I worked in Winnebago as a public defender. I worked in this caseload for over 3 years as a prosecutor. I've been to 3 psychiatric wards myself, inpatient, as a patient. I know this stuff. And the reality is that this court has a practical effect on our ability to provide access to individuals that need it. It does. It has a profound impact on our ability to provide public safety, on our ability to ensure that individuals get the treatment they deserve. That's the reality. I want to make one more comment as we close this session, because having to elicit testimony from fact witnesses at extension hearings perpetuates the family. These types of cases ruin families. They ruin them. I've heard from so many three-party petitioners, why can't you help? Why did this get so hard? And then when they do get their day in court, they have to testify against their loved one at the probable cause hearing. They have to testify against their loved one at the final hearing. Now we want them to testify against their loved one at the first extension, the second extension, the third extension, the fourth extension. This is a civil procedure designed to treat and designed to end. This has ended. RDT's off commitment. I ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals and to conclude RDT's appeal is moot. Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney Martin. Rebuttal, please.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm mindful of the practical difficulties that these cases do present. I mean, the last individual that, you know, is not discussed by the county, of course, is the individual, is RDT, who is being subject to the commitment and is protected by the Constitution through the Due Process Clause, and that he have fair procedures that are set up to ensure that whatever county the, or whatever treatment the county wants to involuntarily impose is, again, consistent with those requirements, is consistent with due process, is consistent with the evidentiary standards that the legislature has set forth in these cases. As to the mootness arguments, I think that the issue as to the cost of care is that I don't think that we have anything here, again, indicating in the record that the debt has been discharged as well. I think at the end of my argument, you know, got into a little bit with Justice Hagedorn here, that I'm not entirely sure what that looks like either, whether even the debt being paid by a third party necessarily ends the matter, in fact, and whether that instead would void the obligation that has been paid, and whether then there's a refund that is owed, whether there is something like that. It is similar to the Second Amendment consequence, as this court discussed in a DK, that by obtaining a reversal, the consequence is voided, it's gone. You know, as to the gun rights and the successive commitments or the successive recommitment in this case, you know, addressing mootness, you know, again, I think that these are questions that are really only relevant to the actual reinstatement inquiry that may happen in the future at some point. And again, it doesn't change the collateral consequence that exists from this recommitment, that it has made his record and reputation worse for purposes of being able to reinstate the gun right. And that, again, we step into the shoes of a different court by trying to go down, you know, a further path there.
Counsel, your opposing counsel offered sort of a burden shifting thing. And I'm also just curious, I understand some of these mootness questions continue to be litigated. I want to give you a chance to comment on his burden shifting proposal. And if not, what you think should happen with regard to how these issues are sussed out.
Right. I don't think that a, you know, statement, the appeal is moot, is, you know, prima facie evidence that, you know, puts the issue into question and that there wouldn't be something like that. I mean, admittedly, I think a lot of it is avoided in these cases as a result of this court's decision in SAM that, again, I think we have sort of categorical non-mootness, you know, again, especially as to the Second Amendment consequences, that even if there's been a recommitment or if there's been a discharge from the commitment, you know, there is sort of no burden shifting that needs to occur in the case. And so it isn't really a question. But that I think that the general rule, and I think we cited in the outset of our reply brief from the United States Supreme Court, that when it comes to mootness, it is usually the party asserting mootness who is it needs to show that as the one trying to raise it essentially as a defense in the case. As of the evidentiary issues, you know, my friend on the other side does discuss, you know, these two Court of Appeals opinions that have, at least one of which has sort of suggested that maybe evidence in the treatment record is just admissible. Again, I think noted in my reply brief, I don't think that it's still connecting the dots, that nobody is still showing what it is in this recommitment standard that makes it an exception to the rules of evidence and means that anything in the treatment record can be used and admissible. I think that, again, it fairly does highlight a different way of showing dangerousness, and that's different. And that does not necessarily mean even having to call firsthand witnesses or mom and dad again at the second, third, or fourth commitments. It is simply about the state finding or the county finding other ways of proving that, other information from the treatment record that may be relevant. And then lastly, some questions from the chief concerning the record as it was presented. I think that the county, I think, when asked to discuss some of the findings that the trial court had made as relevant to dangerousness, I mean, recited some of the testimony from Weber. I mean, this is not the court's findings. The court's findings, again, are minimal. There is no indication of any, you know, sort of non-hearsay evidence, I think, that the court is relying on. I think there's one passing remark after having already ordered the recommitment as to the risk of RDT not resuming his medications that was mentioned, but there's still nothing indicating the ways in which he's going to become dangerousness or that he's going to become dangerous or the information that's happened. I mean, the county instead is reciting mostly information that was about 18 months old, that was at least one recommitment before was the things that Weber was talking about in her testimony. And so, you know, for these reasons, we do ask the court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel for your arguments. We will take a short brief and be back in about 15 minutes for our next oral argument.
Short break.
There are no short briefs. I don't know why they're called briefs.